Welcome to Thursday's programme, another gorgeous day in the Northwest. Not quite as nice as it has been on Wednesday and Tuesday, but decent enough. It's Thursday, the 1st of April, 2021, with me at the BBG, with you until 7 o'clock. Two terrific guests lined up for you today. Looking forward to hearing from you on social media too. Let's do the programme.
It's the BBG, not the BBC.
You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It almost sounds like I know what I'm doing, doesn't it? But I don't really. Welcome!
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yes, BBG Richie on Twitter. That's how to reach me during the programme. I'll be joined in the second hour by Kirsty Miller. Now, many of you will have seen a TikTok video which was put online by Kirsty herself, which has gone viral. She's a former nurse, only recently quitting her job to blow the whistle, basically, on things that she could no longer stand by and keep quiet about. Doesn't want to be complicit in a cover-up. Talked about hospital bed numbers, occupancy. Talked about empty wards in a viral video. I'll be joined by Kirsty Miller in the second hour of the programme. Had a conversation with her today. Very interesting lady. Before that, I'll be joined by Kevin Barrett, live from Madison in Wisconsin. Great friend of mine and long-time guest. A terrific guy, truthjihad.com. Lots to talk with Kevin about, of course. There you go. Right, there you are. Yeah, it is nice. How are you? Where you are? You all right, Jar? You hanging on in there? You are? Good, 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 good. All right. As I said, you do say hello to me on Twitter. I'm looking forward to this Easter weekend. I don't know about you. Be nice now, won't it? Be nice, people getting out and about and all of that. Just pick up your litter. That's the message today from the police and from local authorities. You're a shower of backstards, so you are. You went out and about to enjoy the sunshine in the last couple of days, but you left your litter behind you like a shower of travellers. You racist bastard. Yeah, I'll say that from the confines of my studio. I wouldn't say it to a traveller's face now, mind. Although I have done. Over the years at WLRFM in Waterford, I interviewed many a traveller. And said to some of them, not all of them, why don't you pick up after yourself when you leave, when your caravans sail off into the sunset? Why don't you pick up? Of course, not all travellers leave halting sites in a bad way or other places. Anyway, keep digging a hole, Richie, keep digging a hole. I'm gutted. Terrible news this afternoon. You probably heard this, you probably haven't. But the one and only Kay Burley, it's been announced that Kay Burley, would you believe?
Fabulous.
It's all good.
That's her, has left Sky News after 78 years with the broadcaster. 78 years. As a ginger ninja is sailing on into the sunset herself. She's moving on. She's moving out. She's rolling on down the road. It's rumoured that she's going to join Andrew Neil's GB News. Whether that's true or not is totally and utterly irrelevant. We don't care, do we? If Kay's not at Sky, I don't want Kay. That's the way it is. Here's a serious story broken this afternoon by the Daily Mail. I took it and ran with it on my website, richieallen.co.uk. Ecotextile News shared some very disturbing information with the Mail Online. We are not surprised by it, you and me, because we've been listening to the likes of Dr. Vernon Coleman for months now, and months and months and months, about the dangers of wearing face masks. They don't stop you from getting unwell. They don't prevent you spreading anything. Think of a face mask like a chain link fence. Think of a virus like a mosquito, right? We know this, it's garbage. But scientists are now saying that some, not all, but some of the masks currently on sale and being used by Joe Public and Josephine do contain traces of very toxic chemicals, wait for it, including formaldehyde. Yes, the legendary, notorious formaldehyde. Find that story on my website, richieallen.co.uk. Professor Michael Braungart, director at the Hamburg Environmental Institute, he carried out tests on masks, primarily because people were saying that they were breaking out in rashes. So he said, well, I'll find out why. And I quote him, as the Mail Online quoted him. I nicked the story from the Mail Online, but it's an important one, and you always credit your sources. He said, Professor Michael Braungart, he said, what we are breathing through our mouth and nose is actually hazardous waste. Yes, we found formaldehyde and even aniline. And we noticed that unknown artificial fragrances were being applied to cover any unpleasant chemical smells from the mask. In the case of the blue-coloured surgical masks, we found cobalt, which can be used as a blue dye. All in all, we have a chemical cocktail in front of our nose and mouth that has never been tested for either toxicity or any long-term effects on health. Again, credit must be given to the former GP and best-selling author Vernon Coleman. He's been saying that for a long time. Now, you would imagine, wouldn't you, dear listener, you would imagine, that the broadcast media is falling over themselves this afternoon to cover this story, wouldn't you? You would imagine that the story is everywhere. Yes, you say yes, yes?
What kind of fuckery are you?
Are you not paying attention? Are you not paying attention? They're not covering it. Of course they're not covering it. God forbid that they should inform their viewers and listeners that putting those masks over their own faces and the faces of their children might kill them. Yes, richieallen.co.uk for more on that. Do share it widely. Happy Jesus, huh? Don't hug granny either. Do not hug your granny. That's back in fashion. I thought this might have been an April Fool's gag in the press this morning, but it isn't. It's genuine. Do not hug your granny, because hugging her might kill her, and we don't.
Don't kill granny.
We don't kill granny. Whatever you do, don't kill granny. The UK government is launching a new advertising campaign where it will urge you and me to keep following the rules and stay the hell away from granny, even if granny has been vaccinated and you have been vaccinated, or even if just granny has been vaccinated, because the vaccines don't stop you getting the virus, whatever it is. It's just one big scam from start to finish, from top to bottom, isn't it? So a senior government source told The Telegraph that this is going to be a campaign. It's going to be based around granny, because too many of us are having a good time and then going to granny's, right? We know this.
Enjoy yourself and kill a granny is the answer.
That's right, that's right. Don't forget, having a good time now might kill granny later.
What is the point of seeing granny on Christmas Day if you end up burying her in the new year?
Yes, yes, exactly. And you could substitute Christmas Day for Easter Sunday. What's the point in seeing granny on Easter Sunday and giving her an Easter egg and then burying her on what's the next holiday that comes after Easter Sunday? On Bank Holiday Monday, that's it. Just don't kill your granny. What a dystopian world is unfolding in front of our eyes, eh? Eh? Step away from the granny. Step away. Put your hands up. That's where it's going. Stay away from granny. Boris Johnson has been speaking out on vaccine passports this afternoon because, allegedly, the Labour Party leader, Keir Starmer, remembered this morning, just briefly remembered, that he's the opposition leader and that from time to time you've got to actually, to avoid falling foul of the Trades Description Act, you've actually got to oppose something. I know, right? You've actually got to say, I disagree with that. Starmer has allegedly expressed some disquiet about vaccine passports, but he hasn't really. He's such a rotten bastard, is Starmer. He hasn't really. He said passports would be against the British instinct. He said it shouldn't be left to pub landlords and businesses to implement the scheme. And then he went on to say that he would wait until Michael Gove publishes his review before deciding whether to oppose the idea. So really the story is a load of old bollocks. Starmer isn't saying that he's against vaccine passports at all. No, of course he's not. No, this is the guy who has waved everything through, all of the tyranny of the last 12 months. Starmer has said, yep, that's fine by me. But of course he hasn't. I'm lying. He hasn't said every time Johnson has said we need to do this or do that. He hasn't said it's fine by me. He said it's not enough. You need to do it faster and harder. Kill them, screw them, ruin their businesses. That's Keir Starmer. So yeah. Michael Gove, by the way, is expected to publish his review, I'm told, on the 4th or the 5th of April. So that would be when? Tuesday? Around Tuesday next, is that right? I believe Gove will come back and say, yeah, we need some sort of vaccine passport, like they have in Israel, so that people can feel safe when they leave their houses and go down to the shop. Now, there are all sorts of leaks coming out. Whether you believe them or not is up to you. One of the leaks is that you won't need a vaccine passport to go to Lidl or Aldi or Asda or Tesco or Morrison's or Sainsbury's. You won't need one. You'll be expected to wear a mask, but you won't need a passport. But you will need a passport to prove either you've had a vaccine or you've passed the test, or been found negative, I mean, in a test, to get to your pub, your cinema, your theatre, your concert, your football match, or whatever. It's exactly 10:30 past 5 o'clock. Do you want to hear Johnson then? Here's a little bit of Johnson today. You don't want to hear him? Well, we'll hear a bit of him. Here he is.
I think the most important thing is to continue the rollout of the vaccine programme for everybody. I think when it comes to... So I think that on the issue of a vaccine certification, there's definitely going to be a world in which international travel will use vaccine passports. And you can see that already other countries, the aviation industry are interested in those. And there's a logic to that. I think when it comes to trying to make sure that we give maximum confidence to business and to customers and here in the UK, there are three things. Is your immunity, whether you've had it before, so whether you've got natural antibodies anyway, whether you've been vaccinated, and then, of course, whether you've had a test. And so those three things working together will, I think, be useful.
It'll be useful, says Boris Johnson there, the Prime Minister. Hey, a vaccinator was on the radio this morning. A vaccinator, dear listener. A vaccinator. I couldn't organise a piss up in a brewery today. I'll say it again. A vaccinator. That's more like it. Eh? I've got two dwarves working for me on work experience. They can't reach the controls. When I said vaccinator, you were supposed to press the button. Little bastard. Right. There was a vaccinator on LBC Radio this morning. A vaccinator. And the vaccinator wasn't happy. Why? Because some of you lousy bastards, some of you selfish pricks, are not keeping your vaccine appointments. Here's a vaccinator with a Geordie accent speaking to Nick Ferrari on LBC.
Another problem we're seeing is that we have booked 1,100 appointments every day, and about 200 people aren't showing up for their appointments.
God. Listen to Nick Ferrari. Oh, God almighty. I love it. I love the rubbish from these radio presenters. Oh, God. I can't believe that. God.
And about 200 people aren't showing up for their appointments.
Oh, God. Bet.
It's outrageous.
It's outrageous that you would make a vaccine appointment and then you wouldn't show up. It's just outrageous. But they could find somebody loitering outside, as was suggested on Good Morning Britain. Or was it BBC Radio 5? It might have been Radio 5. Just there's always people hanging around on the off chance that there are some spare jabs at the end of the day. Anyway.
Also, we are.
Cheer Ferrari.
rolling out the Moderna vaccine in the middle of April. So there will be another supply.
But what about supply? On a typical day, you look to do 1,100, 200 irresponsible people sometimes don't turn up. But what are your supplies looking
bastards.
Like next week? Roughly 1,100 a day again? Roughly?
We've got that many appointments booked, but you can bet your bottom dollar all those people won't.
Well, I know. I went to St. Saviour's National School in Ballybeg, right? Here's my solution. Why don't you book 1,300 people then? Why don't you do what the airlines do? Book 1,300, and then when 200 don't show up, it won't matter. And even if they all show up, you can just shrug your shoulders and rebook the 200 extra for another day. I don't know, it's just me.
But so you, there's no... Sorry, I didn't make myself... This is my fault. You have got... You're confident you'll have around 1,000 in stock each day?
Yes, oh, yes.
Yeah. How long are they good for, Janet? Once they arrive and you put them in the fridge, how, what's their shelf life? Do you know?
The 21st of June, our stock is at the moment.
So the ones you get now, the end of March,
day.
Give you...
No, no, the ones we've got...
Like a can of Stella, basically.
...got in at the moment.
Yeah, so when were they delivered? When were they...
Last week.
OK, interesting. And
also, a lot of people, right, the cancellations are happening because the GPs are ringing the people and say, do you want to come here for your jab? You can come tomorrow if you want to come.
Yeah, there you go. That's why the cancellations are happening. The vaccinator. Do let me know, by the way, if you've had your invitation. Because you might have had it. By now, 16 minutes past the hour, the Richie Allen Show, live from Salford, where it's still very warm in studio. Not as warm outside as it has been, as I've already said. So we'll move on. You probably know that well. The dreaded long COVID has been in the news again today. Long COVID.
Ben Hancock. Long COVID.
Long COVID. I spare no expense. Long COVID. Bewitch you forever. You get it. If you get COVID, most of the time you'll recover. But for some people, well, you'll have it forever. Like herpes. You carry that shit forever. Eddie Murphy once said famously, like luggage forever. Herpes. Yeah. This is such horse shit, this next news story. You could fertilise, I reckon, every field in Europe with it. Apparently, 1 in 5 people have symptoms of long COVID 5 weeks after the initial infection, and 1 in 7 after 12 weeks. Wait for it. It estimates, now wait for it, this is the Office of National Statistics, isn't a medical agency, the ONS, estimates that 1.1 million people were affected in the UK by long COVID in the 4 weeks from the 6th of February. Imagine that. Do you believe that? I don't believe it at all, to be honest. Not at all, at all. 1.1 million people had long COVID in the 4 weeks from February the 6th. About 20% of people said that ongoing symptoms limited their day-to-day activities a lot. People were asked to report their own symptoms. There is no scientific basis to this study or survey. It's people reporting it themselves. Here's a Sky News Aisha Zahid with the latest.
Absolutely. I think this new data is going to be reassuring for those suffering from long COVID to see that the condition is being recognised. And it's definitely, I think, going to help medical professionals in helping treat these patients. Now, we know that as of March this year, there's over 1 million people in the UK suffering from the condition. So let's take you through some of the most common symptoms that have been reported. We know that fatigue is one of them, as well as muscle pain. Shortness of breath and headaches. Now, long COVID is classed as still having symptoms 12 weeks after contracting the virus, and it's most prevalent in those aged between 35 to 69 years old, with women reporting long COVID more than men. But today we've also had some positive news from the ONS. A recent survey into vaccine hesitancy showed that 22% of British black adults still have hesitancy towards getting the jab. Now, this is definitely welcome, seeing that in January this figure stood at 44%. Now, there's been real big drives to encourage people of colour to get the vaccine across the country. Earlier this week, we saw Sir Lenny Henry release a video with prominent black figures encouraging people to take the vaccine. And we've also seen a push from the government. So it's really showing that these campaigns are starting to pay off.
They're paying off.
Get the bloody jab.
That's the one.
Get the bloody jab.
Get the bloody jab. So it was 44% scepticism amongst black men or black adults. Now it's 22%. The propaganda is working. I don't have to tell you, because I think you know, that if you have a flu, a bad flu, if you have bronchitis, if you have pneumonia and you get over it, you can often be left achy and tired and run down for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks later. This is the truth now. Long COVID, my backside. I think there's a market for a new phone service, isn't there? You've already got the Samaritans, right? We shouldn't mock the Samaritans, and I'm not going to, because it has done a great deal of good for people over the years and still does. But I think there's a business out there. We need to launch a website and a new phone line, a helpline, and we'll call it Hypochondriacs Anonymous. That's what we'll call it, because that's what you'll get now from now on in. Yeah, and of course the long COVID garbage is all about one thing and one thing only, making coronavirus seem to be a lot worse than it actually is. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Do you want to giggle? Jeremy Vine, BBC Radio 2, every day, sadly, noon to 2 o'clock, was looking ahead to life after coronavirus and what it would mean for working, the working place, the workplace. So we had a couple of commentators on. One of them was an author. The other was just a talking head. One of his guests said, it's all over. The old way is gone. There is a new normal. Working from home will become the new norm. And wait for this. All of those empty city buildings that will be vacated by corporations because the corporation staff will be working from home. Wait for it. One of Vine's guests said today, the empty city buildings could be turned into housing for young people. How Agenda 2030 of him? Human settlement zones. I do remember reading David Icke books going way back when he said that cities would be turned into human settlement zones and rural areas would be basically vacated. Imagine that. That's what the guy said. Everybody will work from home. You'll have all of these empty buildings, office buildings in the cities. We'll get young people in there into smaller dwellings and it'll be more affordable for them. And they'll work from there. And people who live in the suburbs, just outside cities, well, they'll work from home. Wow. Then he took calls from the great unwashed. You'll hear Marie from Newcastle in a moment. Before you hear Marie from Newcastle, Vine reads out a text message from a listener.
We're talking about work and the changing office. Lee in Hemel Hempstead says, I shielded from March to June last year, but being self-employed and renting a workshop, I had no choice but to come back to work. There's nothing in place for people in my situation. I try to be as safe as possible, but it'll never be as safe as being at home. Well, please God, we get all the vaccines done and it's going apace.
You just heard a BBC presenter say, please God, we get all the vaccines done and it's going apace. That's a BBC presenter. Please God, we get the vaccines go. Anyway, he gets Marie on and then it's kind of funny.
And you're safe. That's the key thing. Marie in Newcastle. Hello, Marie.
Hi.
Now, are you home or office person? What's your preference?
I've been working from home since before the pandemic.
Yep.
And I'm hoping never, ever to have to go back to an office. It's just...
Oh. She never, ever wants to go back to an office now, ever. Why?
Oh, for 100 reasons. It's, you know, it's the commute. So I'd start my commute at 8 and I would start work at 8. So just the previous person saying that affects productivity. My employers are getting more out of me because that commute time I'm now working through.
Tell me a little bit about the geography. So I know Newcastle. Were you commuting into the city centre or what?
Actually, my previous job was only about a 15-minute walk away. But one of the other things that I really enjoy is the girl I used to sit next to at work, she got a puppy and a puppy cam, and every day she'd turn her screen around to show us the puppy cam.
Oh. Oh, brilliant. Why are you so intent on working from home? Why do you want to keep working from home? This is just gold.
Joy is the girl I used to sit next to at work, she got a puppy and a puppy cam.
So puppy
and
cam.
Every day she'd turn her screen around to show us the puppy cam.
Oh.
And a little figurine would fall off the top and the noise it made, the anxiety. I mean, it sounds stupid.
The anxiety. The girl next to me had a puppy cam because she had a puppy at home, and every day she would turn the screen around and she would knock something and something would fall, and the anxiety, says Marie.
But little things like that, there's nobody distracting you, there's nobody wasting your time, nobody's telling you that they don't feel very well.
I don't think Marie likes people very much.
So I'm just trying to visualise this. This would annoy me as well. She's got the desktop, she's got the puppy cam on, she turns it to show you,
yeah.
And you're not interested, why would you be? And the
What do you mean, why would you be? What's wrong with puppies?
Figurine falls off the top of the desktop every single time. And what's the figurine? Is it one of those purple ones of a cat or something? Or
It's our mother Mary, is it?
Or
it's a little rabbit.
Oh,
from
gosh.
From
and then
the
same noise every time of it hitting the desk.
Every time. It sounds silly, but just little things like that you don't have to put up with.
It's a bit like Gareth in the office, isn't it, where he hides the stapler, you know?
Oh, my God. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester. My name is Richie Allen. I'm the BBG. This is not the BBC. I'll be speaking to Kirsty Miller, recently resigned Scottish nurse, later on. Before that, Kevin Barrett, live from Madison, Wisconsin. You're very welcome to the programme. Welcome. Yeah, he's one of the greatest of all time, Ray Charles, but we'll cut that one short. 27 minutes past five. Can't wait to chat again with a great friend of mine. He's been speaking to me on my programmes since I began doing this type of radio show way back, going back to my days in Spain. Find him at truthjihad.com, a great academic, author and broadcaster, none other than Kevin Barrett. Kevin, how are you? I think you're...
Very well, Richie.
Ah,
yeah, hey,
there
great
you
to be
are.
With you.
Good man, I thought you might have just dropped out momentarily, but thank God you're there. Loads to get into, Kevin, between now and the top of the hour. One of the things, I had Stephen Lendman on the programme yesterday. Now, I know you know all about Stephen, a great guy, and again, somebody I've known for many years. And like yourself, he's a very, very shrewd journalist and analyst, and like yourself, wouldn't be prone to making, you know, crazy proclamations about things. But he said something to me yesterday that I don't go along with, but it seems to be gathering a bit of traction. And that is that there's two Joe Bidens. There's Joe Biden, the real Joe Biden, that's been hanging around DC for donkey's years and who served as Barack Obama's vice president. But apparently there's an actor Joe Biden appearing for him. I don't want to reduce our conversation now to silliness, and we've got so much else to talk about, but have you heard this, and is there any truth to it at all, or is it just silliness?
Well, I've heard this, and I have no idea whether there could be any truth to it or not, really. I've noticed there are people show pictures that seem to, you know, show a slightly different-looking Biden face from, you know, eons ago to today, or even from just a few years ago to today. And I saw Steve Bannon on The War Room laughing about this and saying that Biden's had heavy-duty plastic surgery, but the way it was treated, it sounded like Bannon might also be questioning whether there was a double there. Of course, Jim Fetzer, who's somebody who's, I think some of his views are a little extreme, even for me, but he's been pushing this really hard now for 6 months or more, saying that there is a Biden double. But Jim kind of thinks everybody's doubled. In fact, sometimes when I talk to him, I wonder whether it's his double. So I don't know, Richie. Your guess is good.
No, I don't buy it for a minute at all. Do you know, the technology with deepfake is so good now. I believe that there's a concerted effort. It's been ongoing for a long time, Kevin, but I believe it's picked up in the last 12 months. Most of the independent media and most of what I call truthers end up working against the independent media. And I think this sort of stuff is put out there to make independent media look ridiculous. It's the same as guys blaming coronavirus on 5G, which there's no proof of. I believe that 5G will be very harmful for people. In fact, I've had some experts on the programme who've said that, people like Chris Busby and others. But, you know, to say, I wonder these stories get out there, and I think it's to put, I shouldn't say ordinary people, but people who haven't yet found the independent media, I think these stories get out there to make us all look like a bunch of idiots. That's just my opinion. And I don't want to be casting any aspersions on Jim. I've known Jim for years. I love Stephen Lendman, so not at all. But I just think some of this stuff is made to make people think that we're a bunch of loons when we're not. You're an academic of great experience and of great, I should say, achievement. So we'll leave that one there for now. Tell me about where you are and coronavirus and vaccine passports, Kevin. The governor of Florida seems to be on his own, Ron DeSantis, in saying, I don't think Americans should have to carry a passport to declare that they're well, to get into a film or to a drive-in or to go for a meal at a restaurant. But it seems everywhere else, apart from one or two southern governors, Everybody else seems to want to go down this really chilling dystopian road. What do you think?
Yes, I think it's horrific. I'm certainly not planning on carrying a vaccine passport around. I don't even have a portable phone. I carried a portable phone briefly in 2008 when I was running for Congress, got rid of it, and I would never have one again. I mean, who wants to carry a tracking device that can also make phone calls and that irradiates you? You know, I've been reading Arthur Furstenberg's Invisible Rainbow, The History of Electricity and Life, and I think we're being horrifically zapped by the electromagnetic pollution around us. And 5G certainly is going to make that worse, and probably without a doubt, I think, is making COVID somewhat worse. I don't think it's the only explanation for COVID. But I'm all with DeSantis on this, and I hope that there will be enough people who will rise up and try to stop these vaccine passports before they start, because otherwise we're going to be in an apartheid world, and it looks like I'm going to be a Palestinian.
Yeah, isn't that ironic? We used to refer to Palestine as this great, not great in terms of good, but this big open air prison where human rights are violated every day of the week, every minute of the day, and here we are now, where people have, and I know I've asked you this before, Kevin, but it's a question that bears repeating again and again and again. Why are people going along with it? Why are they going along with things that are designed to ruin them economically, to ruin them financially, of course, to ruin their health? You know, staying indoors, not assembling with people, not going out and having fun, wearing masks, taking vaccines that are still on trial and that are not even vaccines. People must instinctively know, Kevin, that these are terrible things. And yet, let's be honest about it, there is no pushback against it. Why, Kevin? You're a genius. You're a man who's been studying people for years. Why? Why would you allow yourself to be ruined and just carry on? Why?
Well, there's some pushback. There's the low-key pushback in the alternative media, and then there are these demonstrations. You've had more of them in Europe than we have here in the U.S., but you're right. There isn't nearly as much pushback as there should be. I think it has to do with this new method of controlling people that they developed, especially since 9/11, which there's the whole school of psychology called terror management theory that explains that people, especially presumably in a secular culture, are guided primarily by fear of death, and it's kept unconscious. And anything that threatens to make our fear of death conscious is going to bring up anxiety, and then we're going to try to repress our knowledge that that's what's going on, and we will become ultimately malleable. And that's what they've done with 9/11, especially with the anthrax component of the 9/11 anthrax false flag. They were able to tap into people's fear of getting poisoned in the mail. You know, I guess fear of getting blown up in an office building wasn't enough. And now with COVID, they've really got an effective fear delivery vehicle, because, you know, not everybody works at the top of the World Trade Center. And eventually the anthrax mailings stopped coming from the neocons. But with COVID, it's the gift that keeps on giving. It spreads by itself. And so they've tapped into this fear of death and elicited hysterical behavior, mass hysteria. And that's what we're living through right now, is an episode of mass hysteria driven by fear of death.
And my experience of meeting people, and I never, unless somebody recognizes me, which does happen from time to time, but I'm no celebrity, so I don't get recognized very often. But unless somebody does, I would never say to somebody, listen, I happen to make a radio program and this is what I talk about. I prefer to be talking to people who don't know that I have a vested interest in what's going on because of what I do. And I ask them all the time, Kevin. And sadly, most of them, and this is in my local parks now when I'm out with my dog, most people say they're happy to go along with the mask wearing and we have to be careful. And this really upsets me, you know. And then I will ask them, do you know anybody who died or who was gravely ill? And this is not a forensic or a scientific poll, of course not. But I've yet to meet anybody who can tell me that they knew anybody who was gravely ill or who died. I meet people who say, yeah, I had a bit of a thing, a few days, it wasn't great. Or my granddad had it, he wasn't great, he had to be brought to accident and emergency, he went to casualty, but he was okay. But you it's a struggle to find anybody who lost a family member or a close friend. It really is ingenious, this scam, isn't it?
Yeah, that raises interesting questions about the excess death counts. And there's a big controversy about that going on right now. I, too, don't think I know anybody personally that I've actually met in real life and remember and then heard that they were gravely ill from COVID. I do know, however, some people that I haven't met in real life, including my editor at American Free Press, who was apparently just very close to having to be put on a ventilator. And then there's a guy who comes to my 9/11 lectures in Denver, Colorado, who apparently was really sick too. So apparently, you know, I think there are really some people who are getting sick from this. But yeah, it's true that it's not the kind of threat that the plague was in its day, or even the Spanish flu. And they've weaponized it. In obviously, there's a whole agenda behind it. Some people talk about Agenda 21, and I think that's part of it. And the new normal, the Great Reset, all of that. And I think there's a geopolitical angle here too, Richie. You know, and just to make this really brief, I think there are really two tenable theories for how COVID happened. One is the Ron Unz theory that it was a U.S. bio attack on China that just had horrific blowback that they weren't expecting. The bird flu and the swine flu that took out China's meat supply, that worked fine. It was contained in China, likewise SARS and MERS. But COVID, oops, it blew up in our face. So that's Ron's theory. My theory is that, well, maybe that's part of it, but the larger situation here is that the West needs to try to cull its older folks because there are too many retirees in the baby boom generation to be supported by the ever-shrinking working population. And then they also need to basically become a totalitarian China-style society in order to compete with China. You need that for big data, AI, and all of that. They need to have an Internet of Things and basically control everything really intensively to have a society that's equally productive that can keep up with China.
Yeah,
that's my theory why they did it.
Yeah, it's very interesting that, and I'm certainly not. I wouldn't dismiss any of that. With respect to Ron's theory, I'm not sure about the bioweapon coming from the US, only because I think it would have been something a bit nastier. As far as I understand, whatever coronavirus 19 is, COVID-19, if it actually exists as a virus, and I'm prepared to accept that it might, I'm also prepared to accept that it might not, because I'm open-minded, and I've had both opinions expressed on this programme, but working on the idea that it's a genuine virus, it isn't much, well, in fact, it isn't worse than the flu. And Kevin, I did speak to a very interesting lady called Dr. Tess Laurie the other evening, a lovely lady. Tess is you'd describe her as an establishment lady, a medical doctor, scientist who evaluates medicines and has done recently for, believe it or not, for the World Health Organization. And she came on this programme to say that ivermectin is being ignored by our medical authorities, not only here but everywhere else. But she also said that she believes that respiratory infections like the flu have been re-diagnosed as coronavirus 19, because like in the United States, here in the UK, they've been telling us now for months that flu is gone, Kev. I mean, they've been telling you that in the US as well, haven't they? We've had no flu this season. I mean, they think we're stupid. I mean, they must do. They must think we're sick. Absolute sick that will never, you know, will never wake up to it. This is the case in the US, isn't it? Flu has disappeared.
Yeah, that's the official story, of course, is that it got out-competed. And I'm not enough of an expert to really know whether that could be true or not. And when I try to figure out whether or not there really is this kind of threatening pandemic, the one statistic that seems like it would be useful would be the overall death count. And there's been a controversy around that. The official U.S. excess death count for 2020 is about 500,000 people, which is a huge blip. It's like a 10% rise.
Massive, yeah.
And so if that's true, then indeed, almost certainly there is a COVID pandemic that is, you know, killing people, and they end up with glass in their lungs and so on and so forth, like we're told. Now, Germaine Brie, I think, I'm forgetting her precise name, from Johns Hopkins, published a piece about this very recently that was an update of what was published in the student newspaper Johns Hopkins last fall. And she was really questioning this and arguing that there was systematic exaggeration of overall death counts in the U.S. But I've got some really good scientists I talked to working on this, And the last I heard from this is that there probably were at least 350,000 to 400,000 excess deaths in the U.S., regardless of these exaggerations. So that would mean that, yes, there really is something that kills people, because the flu typically would kill 20, 30,000 in a year. Nothing remotely like almost 500,000.
What about a bad flu season, Kevin? When was the last time the US had a terrible flu season? Was it 2015 or was it 2010? It was one of those years. I wonder how many excess deaths did you have back then? Because my next question for you would have been, how is your government evaluating a coronavirus death? How does it come to the conclusion somebody died of COVID? Very briefly, you know that in the UK, if somebody dies within 28 days of having tested positive for coronavirus, they are listed as a COVID death, which is extraordinary, Kevin, because you have people dying of heart attacks, but because 3 weeks previously, or strokes even, but because 3 weeks previously they tested positive, they're listed as a COVID death. Is it similar in the States?
Yes, absolutely. And it is kind of ridiculous how if you die a month after testing positive for COVID, even though you never got very sick from COVID, you'll probably still be listed as a COVID death. Whereas if you die 10 minutes after getting vaccinated, it was just a coincidence. So yeah, I'm skeptical about those kinds of statistics too. But again, the overall death count thing is pretty powerful evidence that there really is a COVID that's killing a lot of really older and sicker people, because the bad flu seasons would kill maybe, 50,000. I think the biggest ones were in the neighborhood of, if it's adjusted for population, you might get up a little over 100,000 for like 1959, 1968, but not much over that. And so if we really had at least 350,000 excess deaths, then that's at least 2.5 times as bad as a really, really bad flu season. Now, whether that justifies shutting everything down, masking everybody, lockdowns, killing the economy, and going to a totalitarian gulag state, I'm not convinced of that at all. I think the way to deal with this, assuming that there really is COVID, which I do actually, is that they should have done, the Swedish model, the Florida model, protect the vulnerable, totally protect the vulnerable, and then let everything else be open for business as usual, because that way it's going to evolve in the direction of becoming less virulent. However, when you use these containment measures, especially vaccination, according to this new analysis by Gerrit van den Bosch, what you're doing is you're breeding it to become more virulent. So we may not have that bad of a COVID yet, but just wait, it might keep getting worse with variants upon variants upon variants. And then they'll just blame the anti-vaxxers instead of the real source of the problem, the vaccine. So that's, I'm actually worried about what Van den Bosch is saying.
No doubt. We're going to talk politics now. Kevin Barrett is my guest, American Free Press writer, also truthjihad.com, broadcaster and academic. Is Kevin. Now, Spiros Gouras has been in touch, friend of ours, friend of this program's. He's interviewed Daniel McCarthy recently. Daniel is a former Senate candidate who's going to run for governor in Arizona. And he's been on local radio in Arizona. And he's told the local radio there that his source in Washington, D.C. has said that the CEOs of airlines are meeting today behind closed doors to plan the rollout of vaccine passports for travel. And Spiro says McCarthy, Daniel McCarthy, has a good track record and he's very credible. Interesting news. Thanks for that, Spiro. With Stephen Lendman on the programme last night, undoubtedly or unsurprisingly, we spoke a little bit about Iran and Russia and China. And Stephen talked about how those countries are, forming alliances, economic alliances and strategic alliances. And I wanted to ask you, Kevin, about US President Joe Biden and what Biden's inauguration, what his administration might mean for US relationships with Iran and the so-called Iran nuclear deal. What's likely to happen, do you think?
Well, I think Biden is a dangerous president, more dangerous than Trump. And I just wrote an article about this for the American Free Press about Biden stumbling towards World War III. And he sent Blinken up to Alaska to insult the Chinese. He called Putin a killer with no soul. And he is continuing with Trump's insane, over-the-top anti-Iran policy, including these sanctions, refusing to lift the sanctions in accordance with JCPOA, which obviously, if you want to get back into JCPOA, you have to do. But Biden's not doing it. So he's pursuing an even more aggressive, belligerent foreign policy than Trump was. He's reversing Trump's pullout from Afghanistan. He's reversing Trump's attempted pullout from Germany. The endless occupation of Germany is one of the horrific scandals of the American empire. Likewise with Japan, after holocausting both of those two countries with literally by roasting hundreds of thousands of civilians alive by just bombing cities full of civilians for no military purpose, which we did to both Japan and Germany.
Dresden.
Now we're permanently occupying those countries. And at least Trump was, you know, he's a crazy, he's erratic, but at least he saw that the days of this empire are pretty much over. It's time to go back, be a normal country, look out for our country's self-interest in a modest way. Biden hasn't noticed that Trump just drove the empire into the ground and off the cliff, and it's not there anymore. So he's going all out to try to restore it, and that is going to lead to serious trouble.
And these sanctions, I'm very interested in Stephen last night and what he was saying about that. That with the, I mean, Russia, China, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, Iran. They've had that common enemy for generations, the United States and the UK and France and Israel. But it seems that there's been a real escalation in recent months in terms of them expanding their own relationships, Kevin. And that might mean that sometime in the future, sanctions by the United States against these countries might have little or no effect whatsoever. At the moment, they're dreadful and they have real world consequences for Iran, as they have done for Venezuela and other countries. Syria, of course. But in the near future, and I should have mentioned Syria, of course, along with Iran and Russia and China. But in the future, this might all come back to bite the United States. What do you think?
It already has. Iran has been forced to go all in with the new Eurasia led by Russia and China. And they just signed this $500 billion pact with China that's bringing in China to rebuild Iran's infrastructure. There's a security aspect to this arrangement. So instead of being a neutral country, which is ultimately what Iran is going to be, it's got to be neutral. But now it has the only way they can remain sovereign and relatively neutral is to get tight with the Chinese. Why is that? It's because of these insane American policies that are not in America's interest in any way, shape, or form. No matter how you define those interests, this is basically suicidal, because now Iran is going to be the most intensive part of this anti-U.S. alliance. And that's disastrous for U.S. geostrategy. As Brzezinski wrote in his book, The Grand Chessboard, the single most important point for the U.S. as it tries to maintain its dying empire for a few more decades is to keep Iran either on our side or at least neutral. But because the Israelis have a problem with Iran and they own the American government, or at least Mideast policy, they haven't allowed the U.S. to do that. So just as the Israelis essentially trashed the U.S. empire and U.S. democracy by blowing up the Twin Towers and murdering 3,000 Americans on 9/11. Yeah, it wasn't just Israelis. Their American assets helped them.
We've been arguing about that for years. We totally disagree on that. I'm just getting that in there in case our listeners don't know. I don't agree with Kevin on that, but it doesn't matter whether I do or not. And it's not because I have any fear of criticizing Israel, but anyway, Kevin, yeah.
Right, so it's the same with Iran policy. The reason that the U.S. hasn't pursued its own interest by trying to be friendly with the Islamic Republic of Iran is because Israel owns our Mideast policy and won't let us.
Yeah, the U.S. approach to the Middle East is dictated by Israeli lobbyists, as is the U.K. approach to the Middle East. There's no doubt about that. Kevin Barrett is our guest. We're coming up for 10 minutes to the top of the hour. TruthJihad.com, American Free Press. Check out Kevin if you haven't checked him out before. So the other thing about Biden, of course, is that, and I don't care who he is, you try not to mock or belittle, you know, somebody of his age, regardless of what position he holds or how dangerous he might be. He's a senior man. He might have cognitive problems. You might laugh at me saying might. It might be obvious. I don't know. And he might not be long for the world. And if he wasn't to see out a term as president, maybe half a term, maybe a bit longer, maybe less, well, then Kamala Harris would be sworn in. What do you know about her, Kevin, and her ideas, and particularly her approach to the Middle East and the issues we've just been discussing? What do we know about this woman?
Well, I don't think she knows very much about the Middle East or foreign policy in general. She's a prosecutor, a California prosecutor, who earned a reputation as being pretty nasty, hard-nosed, a game player who, you know, is never going to stand for principle or what's right, who's always going to do what's expedient. That's not surprising that these are the kinds of people who reach the highest levels of power. So she doesn't know anything about foreign policy. So where is she going to get advice from? That's always the question. And her husband, it turns out, is a wealthy Jewish Zionist who's very tight with hardcore supporters of Israel. So obviously that Israeli control of American policy that I talked about would continue under President Harris.
And the beat goes on, essentially. I don't think there's ever been an administration in my lifetime. There's never been an administration in your country that ever really sympathized with the Palestinians and ever tried to do anything for them. I can't think of anybody.
John F. Kennedy.
But I said, I did say in my lifetime now, okay. To be fair. Yeah, but you know, I mean, I was born in 1974. Since then, we've not had any opposition to Israel's apartheid policies in Palestine. So we haven't. I mean, in the UK, we haven't either. We've had opposition Labour politicians, you know, over the years, John Smith, people like Michael Foote. We had people like Tony Benn who, you know, would speak at marches and rallies, but never anybody in any serious position that could ever do anything. And that's just the way it's always been, hasn't it?
Pretty much, it seems, yeah. And they manage to torpedo anybody before they get close to power who is likely to stand up against them. Here in the U.S., we've had Cynthia McKinney, for example, who blew the whistle about the fact that if you're elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, they try to force you to sign a loyalty pledge to Israel.
The pact.
And if you don't, then you're their enemy and they're going to get you out. And they got her out twice. They manufactured incidents. They threw tens of millions of dollars at primary opponents. And they've done this to some of the very best American leaders, people like William Fulbright, who was the guy that my Fulbright scholarship was named after. Arkansas senator, considered the best foreign policy mind in American politics, some would say in the whole post-World War II period,
yeah.
But he got knocked out of Congress by the Israelis because he was standing up for American interests rather than Israeli interests. And there have been a number of others, Paul Findlay and James Abu-Risk and others have been knocked out of politics. And so the word has gotten around, basically, if you get to high positions in the U.S., you have to serve Israel first and America second.
That Cynthia McKinney story is interesting. She told that, I think the first place she ever told that story at length was on my radio program, and my mouth was hanging open. At one time, Tipper Gore had invited Cynthia because, you know, you look at Cynthia, and I don't mean now to be, I'm going to sound like I'm sexist. I'm not sexist. I don't think I am anyway. But you think back to Cynthia, you know, incredibly bright. She was good looking. I'm not saying she still isn't good looking. She was articulate. She was good looking. She was vivacious. And they might have thought of her as a rising star. But Tipper Gore organised a dinner for her, didn't she? And she said, come and have dinner and we'll get you hooked up, we'll get you connected. And that was all arranged. And then somebody from Tipper Gore's office got back to Cynthia and said, you didn't sign the pledge. You haven't signed the pledge, the Israeli pledge. So unless you do, we've got to cancel that dinner. My position on Israel has always been this. Some of my listeners believe that I've changed my mind on Israel or that I give them a pass. No broadcaster in history has ever criticised Israel more than I have. I do not believe the country has any right to exist legally. I don't believe it's legitimate and I believe it's a terrible place. But I admire it at the same time. And I don't blame it for what it does, Kevin. I blame our governments, successive governments, for allowing it, the United Nations for passing 700 million resolutions against it but never doing anything. And I blame the media in our countries for allowing Israel get away with what Israel gets away with. So Israel are, for me, down the list on people to blame for what's going on. I think you understand that. We've had this out before. I've no time for Israel, but I have less time for the United Kingdom. I have less time for my own country, the Republic of Ireland, and I have even less time for France and the United States. Israel does what Israel does because it gets away with it. It's like a naughty child. If you don't correct a naughty child and put it back in its place, well, it's just going to get worse, Kevin, right?
Yeah, that's certainly one way to look at it. And yeah, I agree that we ultimately do have to blame the people who are selling out their own countries. And I suppose you could have a little bit of sneaking backhanded admiration for people like the Zionists who are standing up for their own interests when nobody else, like the Americans, aren't standing up for their interests against Israel. So yeah, you can have that kind of admiration. But then you look, well, how do they stand up for their interests by being the most evil, vicious, psychopathic, lying, murdering gangsters that ever lived?
They murder.
I don't have much admiration for them.
No, it's military murders Palestinian children. It murders unarmed women. It does the most despicable and evil things. And I've spent years criticizing Israel. And, you know, I've taken some knocks for it over the years. In the British press, I've been knocked for it. But I always qualify it. You know, I tell the truth, you know. I mean, I can't believe that the Israelis have accepted a green passport. I've had Norman Finkelstein on this programme. I love Norman. And I'll have him on again. And we talked about his mum and his aunt and their experiences of Auschwitz. And I've spoken to, I had a 95-year-old Holocaust survivor on the programme a few weeks back who cannot believe the tyranny that we're kind of walking into now. And you look at the Israelis, how could Israeli people accept a green passport to be allowed to go to the gym or to go to a hotel? The mind boggles, Kevin, right?
Yeah, you'd think they'd already have enough apartheid without adding a whole new layer.
Well, but for themselves, I mean, you think historically, you know, when you think of Ira Papirin Bitte, you think that Jews in Israel, of all people, would say, no, we're not going to carry a QR code on our phones to declare us to be safe to get into a venue. I find it astonishing. But anyway, look, that's for another day. Very briefly, in the couple of minutes that we have left, massive attack on the independent media coming here. They're going to change. They're going to introduce legislation that will ultimately make it impossible for loan operators, but individual content creators like me to do what it is that I do. Now, I know you pride yourselves over there in Yankee land, Kev, about the First Amendment and all of that, but you've got to be worried, right? You've got to think, well, it might happen. You know, the First Amendment might just be obliterated and eventually they might try and shut down guys like you.
Well, they already are. The First Amendment is in many ways a dead letter. I'm right now doing a lot of what I do, not because I'm protected by the First Amendment, which I theoretically am, but because, you know, YouTube won't give me that third strike. They've given me two strikes a couple of times, but they won't give me the third strike. So I'm still on YouTube. I'm raising funds at fundraiser. I kicked off Go Bleep Me. But I was able to find another platform where I can operate. But unfortunately, none of this is protected by the First Amendment. If we're doing political commentary and critical analysis of the news and of history, and one would think that this would be at the very top of the kinds of activities protected by the First Amendment and by all Western free speech values, we're not protected. Those are the very first people that they tend to go after. So, yeah, I think it's going to continue to get harder and harder to do this kind of truth-telling independent media that we do. But that's just another reason that we need to do it even more intensively.
Yeah, it's just a challenge, isn't it? It's just a challenge. I've had some really interesting tweets since we started talking about Israel and Palestine. Moinga, who's listened for years, says, I'm with you on Israel. It's admirable what they get away with while we turn a blind eye. Agrees with me, but most of the tweets agree with you. Look, what Kevin and myself have been speaking for many years, and I've spoken with others about the crimes against humanity committed by the Israeli Defence Force. But you got to look at your own country. I'm living in the UK. I'm a taxpayer here. This country exports arms to Saudi Arabia, knowing that those arms are going to be used to blow Yemeni men, women and children to pieces who never, ever raised a finger against the UK. That's as bad as anything that Israel ever did. Look at your own country first, then look at Israel. But I'll talk forever on Israeli lobbying in this country and in America and what it means for peace in the world. Of course I will. Kevin, brilliant to have you on, mate. You can have the last word if you want. Truthjihad.com. And, of course, the American Free Press. You've been listening to the great academic Kevin Barrett, great humanitarian, great friend of mine for many years. Last word, Kev, if you've got something to say, and I can't wait to chat with you again.
Well, thanks, Richie. Yeah, people can also go to my rubric at UNZ.com, UNZ.com. And then I also write for Crescent International, which is the leading Muslim analysis of current events magazine. And so I don't think there's anybody else who's writing for these kind of alt-right type outlets like American Free Press, but also for a kind of left-leaning internationalist Islamic magazine like Crescent, which I really highly recommend. A lot of people in your audience would probably find Crescent International very interesting and enlightening.
Look, and I'll put links on Twitter. I will make a note to put links to those websites on Twitter later on. Thanks again, Kevin. Regards to Rabia, mate, as usual. And can't wait to speak next time.
Okay, thanks, Richie. Rabia says hi to you too.
Cheers, buddy. Thanks for that. Bye for now. Kevin Barrett, folks, live on Thursday's Richie Allen Radio Show. And Rabia is Kevin's partner. Lovely lady she is. It's exactly 90 seconds after 6 o'clock. It is Thursday's programme. It is April 1st, 2021. I'm Richie Allen. How are you? Are you well? Are you warm? It's a bit cooler than it was. In a few minutes' time, I'm really looking forward to introducing to you Kirsty Miller. You saw, I'm sure you saw, a TikTok video that was uploaded by Kirsty earlier this week. She's now a former nurse, sadly. Who felt that she had to resign her post because she couldn't be complicit in a cover-up around coronavirus, particularly around the information being put out by hospitals in terms of, you know, hospital bed occupancy and stuff like that. Had a chat with her this morning. Looking forward to introducing her to you in a few minutes. We'll do that after I take a tune. 2 minutes past six, BBG Richie on Twitter. Everything is one. Danny Wilson, Mary's Prayer on Thursday's Richie Allen Radio Show. 6 minutes past 6 o'clock. We'll be joined, hopefully, I will be, in a couple of minutes' time by Kirsty Miller, just sorting the connection out there. And I'm looking forward to that. If you've got something to say during the conversation, the way to say it to me is, as I've said before, through Twitter. BBG Richie on Twitter is my contact. Is my Twitter handle. Couple of things. This is Easter, the Easter bank holiday weekend. So the next Richie Allen radio show proper will be next Tuesday. That's next Tuesday, right? Because Monday is a bank holiday. I will be with you on Sunday morning for Sunday morning melodies, as usual. So I'll be with you on Sunday at 10, but I'll be off on Monday bank holiday, back with the Richie Allen show on Tuesday. And the following week then, which is the week beginning, I think it's the week beginning April 12th, is it? I think it is. In fact, is it? It is. Yes, I'm off that week, so I'll be away for that week. Just giving you a bit of a heads up. All right? Okay. Take another tune then while we connect to Kirsty. What have I got lined up? Divine Comedy. All right. Back, hopefully, with Kirsty Miller after this from Neil Hannon and the boys. Divine Comedy then and National Express. It's 11 minutes past 6 o'clock, Thursday's programme. Right, let's get into it then. Tracy McCallum, who's been on this programme in the past, a nurse of course, put me in touch with my next guest. A lot of people got in touch with me this week and said you should have my next guest on, Richie. Have you seen the video that she uploaded to TikTok? And I had seen it. I saw it the other day. It's an extraordinary video, really. Kirsty Miller is a nurse, well, was a nurse working in the NHS recently, and resigned her post a few weeks back because she felt she couldn't any longer be complicit in what she saw as a cover-up around coronavirus, and then released that very emotional statement via TikTok. Let's welcome her to the programme. Kirsty, welcome. Lovely to have you on. How are you?
Thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Kirsty. Great to have you on the show. I'm going to get out of your way and let you tell the story. What was it 5 weeks ago that led you to taking the decision to leave your job?
Okay, well, I was working in acute medicine, and the hospitals have been very quiet for the past year. The beds haven't been full. And probably around January time, we've seen an influx of elderly patients with some horrific admissions. And I then started trying to reach out to Unison and the Medical Board of Directors, government, anybody that could sort of try and listen, because I was aware, obviously, the vaccine was rolling out for COVID, and it was quite evident that the admissions were relating to that. My concern was that really that there was no documentation for us, for nurses, or there was no preparation for this brand new intervention that it's never been done before. So where were we meant to document it? There was no sort of media coverage on to tell the public, you know, if you have adverse effects, this is what you must do. So I approached the medical team on shift one night and said about the yellow card system, why are we not reporting it? What's our duty? Can we take the patient's name and personal details to fill it in? They weren't sure. I spoke to the NMC. They told us that there's nothing. They told me it was nothing to do with them. There was no documentation. Like I say, you know, it was a case of the relatives that were telling us if they had the vaccine. It was probably maybe 7 to 10 days prior to admission that they maybe have had the vaccine, and there were some quite traumatic symptoms, especially the elderly. They were off their legs. They were freezing cold. Some of the temperatures were down at 31 to 33 degrees, which I've never seen before, you know. It was heartbreaking to watch. And for me, I was looking around and thinking, why has nobody else seen this or seen anything? And all this year, I've thought to myself, somebody's got to speak out. Somebody's got to say something.
Let's come back to that in a few minutes, the vaccine rollout and what you observed this year. And we'll come back to why others haven't been speaking out. Let's go back to the beginning of it then. So we go back to March, April last year. Tell us about those early months and where you were employed at the time, Kirsty, because you're telling us, and I've heard this from other nurses as well, that the hospitals weren't as full as we were led to believe and that some wards are empty. So go back to the very beginning. Where were you working and what did you see?
So at the start of the pandemic, I was a charge nurse in a care home. All the staff were sort of waiting for this sort of war scene to start. Because of the mainstream footage that we've seen on the television, you know, the news, we were waiting for hell to start, really. We didn't know what to expect, because Wuhan, there was people falling at the floor. In Spain, carers and nurses were running out of care homes, because of the virus. And so we were saying to the company I worked for, the manager there, we were saying, can we get PPE, you know? And they said, no COVID, no PPE. And I said, what do you mean? And she says, well, there's nobody with COVID, you won't be getting the correct PPE. So we were basically having to go into residents and test them. And we'll do their observations. And if anyone came back positive, then we would just have gloves and apron. We'd had no masks or anything. Some of the staff went out and started buying masks and shields. We didn't see a lot at that time, to be quite honest. One resident got admitted into hospital because he had a chest infection. And he came back to us without having the proper test, the PCR test. There was a lot of other things that happened within the care home that didn't sit well with me. And I complained to Public Health and Care Commission, wrote letters to them as well, and then I handed my notice in because it just wasn't right. Thereafter, I was on the NHS bank, and it was very difficult to get shifts because everywhere had sort of shut down, and I was going back and forth to Perth and trying to obviously feed my family and keep going. I ended up with a contract in the job that I've just gave up there at, in the acute medicine unit. It wasn't busy. The beds, when it was busy, don't get me wrong, the staff there in the NHS, they work so hard. They work so hard, and it's never anything against any of the staff that I've worked with or any NHS staff, you know, but we knew that something wasn't right. And, yeah, so there was, we would have six patients in a bed in one ward, and then you would go sort of to other wards, and then beds were shut. Beds were shut down. So we were an admission ward, and we were having patients coming in, and we were testing them for COVID-19.
Why were the why were the other beds shut down? Why were those other wards empty? Did anybody communicate the reason for that to you and your colleagues?
Well, just for this, obviously to prevent
distancing.
Infection.
Right.
That's what we were told. It was, and I, because we were working, I was working on the bank, I was seeing that some wards were different from the others. So as well as working in the same trust, the same NHS trust, different things were happening in different wards. You see?
Yeah, I see what you mean. And what's very interesting is you go back to you working in the care home. It's interesting, and you said this to me today. At the very beginning, staff like yourself were convinced that this was a terrible thing, and you were really, really nervous about what that might mean for your own health. And that's it.
We were all very scared. We thought that we were going to. I mean, there was chances of us dying because of what we were seeing on the news. It was terrifying.
And we heard this last year. We heard this at the outset about the lack of PPE equipment. And I did see nurses on television, and I heard nurses on radio saying that they were horrified that they didn't have the right equipment. And like you, they were really scared that if the virus was as bad as they were told, they would get sick. And, you know, they might take that home to their families. And you have children, so this was a real concern. And tell me a little bit about the care home before we move on, because one of the things we did learn last year was that a lot of deaths actually happened in care homes because they didn't take precautions when they were discharging people from hospitals. Is there anything you can tell us about that, Kirsty?
Yeah, well, the residents were just discharged back into the care home without proper testing, so there was obviously they still had the virus. They went into hospital with a chest infection and come back from the hospital with the virus.
And were you hearing, because they mentioned figures of 30,000-35,000, were you hearing about older people in care homes dying? Were you hearing stories, and did it happen in the care home you were working in?
So by that time, there was one patient, one resident that had come back to us, and he was infected. But at that time, I'd actually left when it got worse. There was 15 residents that died in the care home that I worked in. However, usually round flu season, round the winter months, there is a lot of residents that pass away. You know, they.
If you had a bad flu season. If you had a bad flu season, it would happen in any case. That's what you mean, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, but it just wasn't televised, or it wasn't in the public domain the way it has been, you know, so. But staff, I had coronavirus in 2017. I contracted it, you know, and I had influenza B. I was given Tamiflu for influenza B, but nothing for coronavirus because, really, there was no treatment for it.
And what was it like when you say you had it back in 2017? That would obviously be a different variant, wouldn't it? Because lots of coronaviruses circulate in society in any given winter anyway. So how bad was that back then, if you remember, Kirsty?
Well, I was quite ill, but I stayed off my work for 10 days and I recovered at home. You know, drank plenty of fluid, had my paracetamol, and I stayed at home. And just like we've always been taught, is if you're obviously feeling not well, you just stay at home and recover.
And that's another issue, isn't it? Because so you mentioned the NHS bank, so that means that you're basically putting yourself, you're basically declaring yourself as available to work wherever you're needed. Is that what it means, right? So that's what it means.
Sure.
So you've been around, so then at the, you know, so we're talking then April, May onwards, you're in Perth and you're in other places, so you're really seeing, you're right there to see and to witness the things we're being told on television. We were being told on television that the virus was deadly, that hospitals were overwhelmed, that it was absolute catastrophe. But that wasn't your experience. I think you said to me a few minutes ago, you said, yes, there were obviously days when you were flat out, but other times it wasn't that bad at all.
That's right. That's correct, sometimes I only maybe had 3 patients to look after in a 12-hour shift. You know, it was...
Three patients, wow. And were you having conversations, Kirsty, with your colleagues about, because obviously you're going home to your children and they're going home to their families, and you switch on Sky or Channel 4 News and you're told that it's bedlam, and you're not seeing that. I mean, is that something that you would have discussed with your fellow nurses?
Yeah, I mean, but I think the issue was you would have the conversation and then you could see who was really following the narrative. Even though what we've seen wasn't really what was happening on the news, people were too scared to even question it. But others would speak openly about it, you know? And others would say, even like obviously getting the vaccine and things, others would say, we just want to get the vaccine so we can get back to normal, or so we can get on holiday. And I would say, like, have you researched it? Do you know what's in the vaccine? Do you know the long-term studies of it? And they were like, no, we just want things to go back to normal. We're not caring about anything like that.
How interesting. And we're going to talk about the vaccine in a moment. Let me remind our listeners, Kirsty Miller is on the programme this evening. We saw Kirsty's video earlier in the week. It's been seen millions of times now at this stage, a month or a little bit longer than a month ago, she resigned her post as a staff nurse. She said she couldn't be complicit in a cover-up. It's fair to say you've taken some stick, haven't you? I saw some social media stuff. I've even had emails from people today telling me, you shouldn't have this woman on, Richie. She's a complete actress. She's not really a nurse. She never worked as a nurse before. But you've had to put up with that, But for to get that out of the way, you know, getting that sort of abuse, people saying that you're not really a nurse and that you're just having us all on. What do you say to those people?
Well, I just think it's a shame that they can judge me. They don't even know me. And if that's the way, I mean, their opinion doesn't really bother me. My job is as a patient advocate and my mother. All I'm trying to do is speak the truth and get people's freedom back, because lockdown has caused such a lot of devastating effects to every family, as well as people that have had the virus. You know, like I've lost 2 family members that have died this year. One was taken to ICU and he was put on a ventilator. I spoke to the sisters of him and they support me, they understand, and I'll never disrespect them. I am a nurse. I've trained an NHS Tayside. I'm just sorry to the people that they feel that they have to waste their time and discredit me. You know, they're discrediting me. But
the question for any journalist anywhere is, what does somebody have to gain by, you know, making a video and claiming to be something they're not? Tayside, you trained in.
I was just at the end of my tether. I think on my last shift that I've done in the hospital I worked in, there was a lot of upset and confusion because wards are being shut down. Wards are being shut down. Staff are not aware of where they're going, where their next job's going to be. And this is happening in the middle of a pandemic. Now, on my video, I said, why look after 6 patients? You know, usually I look after 6 acutely ill patients whose, like the news is they're way up at maybe 10, 12. You know, they're very, very ill and need the triple therapy, antibiotics and a lot of investigations to sort of save their life. Latterly, it's not been like that, you know.
That's the thing, I suppose. Again, we come back to this strange, what a strange paradigm it must have been for you, because you're being told, everybody is being told that we're in the midst of a pandemic, that people are dying and we must quit our jobs or work from home and all of the terrible things of lockdown. But you and your colleagues are seeing empty wards, beds, wards shut for social distancing. Sometimes you're busy, sometimes you're not. You're not really in any danger of collapse. I mean, you might be in, I mean, obviously you guys were tired, you were stressed out, but the service itself was under no threat of collapsing, was it? They said it was, but it wasn't.
No. For me as well, I think that obviously I've been in the admission unit and we're doing PCR testing and patients have come back testing positive. There's not a lot of symptoms relating to the virus, but they are transferred over to the COVID ward. But why are we not isolated? So we are not isolated and still have to go to work, but our children can't go to school.
Say that again, Kirsty, because this is important. So you're working in admissions, so you're basically the first nurse that some of these people will see. They don't really have any symptoms, but they take a PCR test that comes back positive. They're not really unwell, and they're admitted.
And
what's going on?
They have to go to the COVID ward, and then the patients that are in that bay where that patient tests positive, they have to be isolated around the hospital, so the side rooms have to be found for them.
Is this why the BBC said today, news came out today that that a lot of people ended up contracting coronavirus inside hospitals? Is that, does that go some way to explaining it? That some people were coming to hospital, they were getting a test, but there wasn't anything wrong with them, and they were kept in, and maybe they developed the virus then because they were in, an environment where
it's possible. I remember one time there was something wrong with the ventilating system as well, and patients had to be, I mean, a whole ward had to be shut down and fumigated because there was something wrong with the ventilation.
And you had these Nightingale hospitals as well that were set up that were never used. So I've got to ask you this, Kirsty. I know that I know over the last few years the NHS took a lot of stick and a lot of criticism because it didn't protect whistleblowers. And apparently it set up a place for whistleblowers to go where they could be safe within the service. Was that something that you considered last year? You know, going to your bosses or going as high as you could to say, listen, what's going on here? Why are we telling people that we're in the midst of a pandemic when we're not? Did you consider going down that road?
Yeah, I did. I spoke to some of my bosses and said that as well. And they just, people are too scared. They're terrified to speak out. And I don't know, like, it's just the fear of doing anything. You know, I was quite vocal about it at work and said, something's not right here, something's going on. You know, why is this happening and people are locked down? And they were like, Kirsty, you know, this is just the way the government says it has to be. You know, but it's not true.
So from their point of view, it was a case of telling you, just get back to work, basically. And keep quiet and get on with it. And then
I phoned the NNC to obviously raise concerns as well. And they said they don't deal with things like that. So I know that I do have colleagues that have not came forward like to show their face or anything, but behind the scenes they're working so hard and we're writing letters again to the NNC, to the government, the English and Scottish government. You know, we're not going to stop. So I'm running for the Freedom Alliance party.
You mentioned this today. Park that for a minute because I'm obviously intrigued about that. And I want to talk about that because I've had Professor Dolores Cahill on this programme before and others like her. Park that first, if you don't mind, Kirsty. Kirsty Miller is our guest. Kirsty is a nurse who began at Tayside in Scotland, recently quit her job because she couldn't be complicit anymore in what she feels to be a big deception. around the seriousness of coronavirus. She hasn't declared that coronavirus doesn't exist, not at all. She says it's real, but it isn't as deadly as we were led to believe, and that when we were being told last year that hospitals were swamped with patients and that people were dying and that this disease was a big threat to us all, that actually wasn't the case. That's what Kirsty has been telling us this evening. Now, we get into the summer and they start talking about the vaccine development and that they might have a vaccine ready by Christmas. And lo and behold, we get to December and they announce, yippee, we've got the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. I think maybe the AstraZeneca Oxford maybe was the first one. Maybe I'm wrong. And we're going to start rolling them out. Was it Pfizer? It was the first one.
Yeah.
And then later, then the Oxford AstraZeneca. And they begin giving these vaccines to people. And you, now, to be fair, I've got to give you a bit of credit. You said to me on the phone today, you said, Richie, this is my opinion. I'm a nurse and I can only go on what I see. You made it clear to me that you're not a virologist and you're not an epidemiologist. But you're concerned, or at least you told me that you're concerned. And I know you said it on the TikTok videos you've done. That there was an increase in illness after the vaccines began to be rolled out. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I think it was January time we've seen an increase in admissions with the over 80s, and they were coming in and they were freezing. I've never seen it ever. They were freezing cold. Their extremities were freezing cold. They were extremely flat and unresponsive. I've seen some with burning eyes, their eyes were burning. We couldn't visually see anything, but they kept screaming their eyes. Some of them were screaming that their legs were burning. There was one night I was working and there was five patients had come in amongst everybody else. And they needed bear huggers because their temperature, they were so hypothermic. We only had three bear huggers.
What's a bear hugger now?
So the bear hugger blows in hot air to heat the body.
Right.
You put the patient in that on the bed, and it heats the heats the patient's body to bring the temperature up to normal.
They weren't coming from freezing cold flats, were they, or apartments or anything?
No, and it was very bizarre because it was all the same time. And for me, then I started questioning. Okay, so have they had the same batch of the vaccine?
Yeah, how could you? And did you try and find that out then? And if so, what did you find?
I couldn't find any details. When the paramedics came in, they weren't aware of any vaccine because we've never been taught. We've never asked. There's no protocol or There's no protocol or policy or anything or any staff training for us at all with this new intervention. So the only way that we knew that it could have been the vaccine is through the family member.
Right.
Because there was no documentation on the ambulance form. There was no mention of it at handovers, apart from me saying to my colleague, have they had the vaccine? Have they had the vaccine? I would say to the paramedics that come in or the A&E nurse that would bring the patient up, have they had the vaccine?
And could your colleagues access that information? So if you're on duty tonight, Kirsty, and you're the admissions nurse, and I come in and my body temperature is very low, I have an NHS doctor, and I'm sure there are records for me. Mm-hmm. Would you or your colleagues be able to determine quickly if I've had a vaccine?
No.
You wouldn't?
No.
Right.
No.
And you said family members told, when family members were coming to see people, you were hearing from them, like, yeah, well, she did have her vaccine or he had his vaccine. Yeah. That's how you found out.
They would never come to visit because they weren't allowed in to visit.
Well, of course they weren't allowed in, Sorry. Yeah I'm an idiot, Jeff, of course.
But it would always be on the phone call. It would always be the phone call because obviously they would phone. I mean, we had admissions day and night. It was just 24/7. So we had phone calls, all the time. And I would ask, have they had their vaccine? And they would say yes. And some would say, you know, they were absolutely fine before it, and then they just deteriorated.
Your critics now will say that this is anecdotal evidence. You know that because you're very, very bright. I'm not saying I don't believe you, by the way. I'm not saying I don't believe you at all. I'm glad you're on the programme and people should hear this. But your critics will say that's anecdotal evidence. Now, we need harder evidence. But am I right in saying that the vaccine began to be given in Scotland and in England, in the UK, around about mid-December? Is that right? Is that when they first started giving it out? Well, I'm very interested in Scotland alone, 2,207 people died within 28 days of a vaccine between mid-December and between the 26th of February. That sounds like a lot to me, although I'm willing to concede that some of those people, you know, they could have died of other things. But surely some of those people might have had complications because of the vaccine, Kirsty, some of them.
Well, that's it. And the problem is that because there's no documentation at all. Now, I spoke to Shauna, who's a nurse in Ireland. Well, she was actually a midwife, and she's raised concerns in regards to mothers getting vaccines as well. And we don't have any documentation as admission nurses, you know, because she worked in admissions for pregnant women. And there's no documentation for us to get.
Now, can you clear this up for me now? Because I'm fascinated by this. So you've explained brilliantly, there's no documentation and there is no protocol in how to deal with, you know, possible injury. So the obvious question for me is then, they give the flu vaccine to whoever will take it every year. Is there any documentation or protocol around the flu vaccine?
Well, yes.
Is there?
I'd done a rollout when I was a nurse in one of the care homes, and you take the batch number, or it's a sticker, and you take it off, and then you put it into the book. It's the own care home's policy to do that. So you've got the batch number from the vaccine that gets delivered from the pharmacist. The doctors.
Now, this is a bombshell, Kirsty. This is a bombshell. This is bombshell information for me, because that tells me that the NHS wants to keep track of people who had the flu vaccine, and it wants to keep track of which batch they were given their vaccine from. And the only reason they would do that is in case there's any problem with it and in case there's any adverse reactions. And you're telling me that pretty simple approach was basically thrown away for the coronavirus vaccines.
Well, I didn't administer the corona vaccine, so I don't know. So there probably is that protocol in place for the nurses administering
for the ones
vaccine.
Given it.
What I'm saying is, there's no passport, there's no vaccine passport in unprecedented times. Where this new vaccine that's never been tried before, it's still under experiment. Why do patients not have this passport? And why are we not prepared on the other side for adverse effects?
That's a $64 million question, isn't it?
Yeah. So I hope we, as nurses, there's quite a lot of us that do have questions that are unanswerable, and we have reached out to the Scottish Parliament, to English Parliament, to NMC. To everyone that we can think of, and none of us have had any answers. And we don't know each other. We've just met each other in forums because of our concerns.
And you told me today that far from being isolated, it's not you, is it? I mean, I met Tracy McCallum, I've met others. Apparently there are more than dozens, there are hundreds of nurses, many of them still working, that are very worried about this situation, and they're asking for answers too.
Oh, I've had hundreds and hundreds of private messages saying, thank you very much for your bravery. I wish I had the confidence to speak out. I'm too scared. We absolutely agree with what you're saying.
And what does that mean? I remember a few weeks ago, the NHS acknowledged that 200,000 workers, what a number that is, expressed that they probably wouldn't be too happy about taking a vaccine. Did that make sense to you? I know, I'm not saying you know 200,000 people now, but you know plenty. Was that what you were getting from your colleagues even before you left? Were they worried about the vaccine and, you know, we won't take it?
Yes, because we're trained, obviously, we're trained professionals to know and to sort of assess and investigate new medications when we're, you know, so obviously we're going to be quite critical and ask, especially when we're seeing that the hospitals are not like a state of emergency and this vaccine is getting rolled out for emergency. There's questions that need asked. That's where colleagues have come from, you know.
I can back up your claim, by the way, that hospitals haven't been as busy because even the BBC itself put information in the public domain only a few weeks ago and I grabbed it. It came from NHS Digital. Bed occupancy by week for winter 29, so that's December, January, December 2019, January, February 2020. So that's before the pandemic. The winter before the pandemic, the bed occupancy rates were heavier than the winter 2020 to 2021. This is a fact. Yeah. This is an absolute fact. It's not my opinion. Things were worse in the NHS in terms of beds filled pre-pandemic in that winter than they are now. That's their own figures, Kirsty.
Yeah, that's true. I don't make up the figures either. I've been in touch with, somebody from Inform Scotland got in touch with me. This is a lady, Christine. She's got a professional background as well into graphs and statistics and data as well. And she says, what you're telling me, Kirsty, is it collaborates sort of with the admissions, you know, obviously with vaccine injury and when they were rolled out. I'm aware that the vaccine was rolled out in late December and stuff like that. But my concentration was when I go to work, it's on my patient care and being a patient advocate. And these people behind the scenes are obviously asking so many questions as well and doing all this amazing work. So what I've been able to say is meeting up with the research that they're doing.
The thing is, you see, what you're saying to me is coming through loud and clear. You believe that they were, at least the media, you're not blaming the NH, you're not blaming your colleagues. You say that the media and the government has basically lied about the extent of the pressure on hospitals during the so-called pandemic, and there is a lot of evidence to support your claim. I'm going to say that, number one. But you're also saying that earlier this year, you as a nurse couldn't give appropriate care to your patients because they might have had a medical intervention that might be doing them some harm, but yet you didn't know anything about it. That's very serious. Liz Jones is listening to this with great interest, and she asks a good question. You might be able to clear this up for us. When somebody has a vaccine, why is that not added to a medical record that can be accessed by someone like you?
I don't know.
I'm stunned at that. Because I would.
We do have there is data out there.
But you can't access it.
No, I can't access it. But when I was asking questions and going to the medical team, they were saying, we don't. I said, they had their vaccine, and they're like, we don't know. Could you find out? Well, we can't find out, you know. I'm saying, what about reporting it to the yellow card team? Well, we don't think that's necessary. And one doctor even said to me, she said, what's the yellow card team?
Did one of the doctors say that? Wow. Just for our listeners, people living in the UK, if they feel that they've had a bad reaction to a vaccine, they can report it on the government's website using what's called the yellow card system. It's basically self-reporting, and it's a strange old system because nobody ever gets back to anybody to ask them any more questions. Like, you go on there and you might say, I've had a headache for 2 days, but there isn't any follow-up, as far as I understand. It's
Kirsten. It stays on the system in case you maybe have a tragic accident or something and you're unconscious and you're going to need medical intervention. They'll know not to give you that medication because it'll be attached to your note.
That's right. And it's been just over, I suppose, 5 weeks since you walked away frustrated and fed up at what was going on. Because you've been very upfront and you were very upfront with your bosses, how did your bosses react when you said that? Did he express any regret or any sympathy for what you were going through? How did they take it?
Somebody from my work phoned last week and asked how I was. They seen my video and they were quite concerned about me and asked if I was okay. And I said I wasn't okay, obviously, because after doing it, I'd done a shift and hearing that wards are getting shut down and lockdowns occurring and all the adverse effects during lockdown. I mean, I had to watch my friend's funeral on webcam. She died of cancer because she never got in for her treatment she never got in for investigation at the start of the year. You know, there's children committing suicide and things. You know, this is what I said to the manager that phoned me. But I said, I've took my name off the register, the NNC register, so I'm no longer practicing in the UK.
You might return. I mean, never say never. You might go back. You might end up in private practice. When I say I'm sorry to hear about your friend, I know I don't know your friend and I don't know you, but I am sorry. I mean, the thoughts of having to pay your respects to somebody on webcam is disgraceful. It's disgraceful that I can't.
I think for me, Richie, it was more challenging because I went on shift one night and she was in hospital. She was in the side room and I had to look after her and she got the bad news and couldn't have her family all in there with her.
You think if things had been different and other services were hang on a second, we've just lost Kirsty there. Let me get her back on. That happens sometimes. What's going on there? All right, give me a second and I'll get her back on. Kirsty Miller is our guest, by the way. Kirsty is in Scotland. A nurse until very recently. She quit because of her disquiet, is one way of putting it. Frustration is another way of putting it, at what she saw happening last year and this year in the NHS. The claims that the service was absolutely snowed under by coronavirus, that the pandemic was leading to so many deaths, that hospital beds were at a premium, when what she was seeing was wards being closed down, shifts that were very quiet, some shifts that were busy, but nothing like the things we were being told on the news and things we were reading in the paper. Sorry about that, Kirsty. Strange thing to happen there. Yeah, it happens from time to time. So we were talking about your friend and I was asking you, you believe that if other services hadn't have been basically ignored for COVID, that her cancer might have been caught a bit sooner.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
How hard is that to take for her friends and her family?
Yeah, it's a tragedy. Well, I'm never ever taken away that obviously people have lost their life from the virus, coronavirus. There's also life being lost unnecessarily through lockdown. And for me, working in an environment that wasn't an emergency, that was declared emergency, and coming home and seeing that hearing about children committing suicide and things, and the elderly in the care homes and watching videos of relatives looking at their mothers and fathers, family members through windows, I was waiting for somebody else to speak out and say something, and it was never happening. And I changed my shifts at work. I went full time, then I went part time, then I went night shift. and the feelings inside me all this time. I was writing letters, speaking out, trying to get answers, trying to be heard. And I knew that I wasn't getting anywhere and I couldn't work in it anymore. And I worked so hard to get where I got with my nursing.
I can hear the sadness in your voice as you speak about that. That can't be easy, that.
Yeah.
And
tell
us about the Freedom Alliance then, and about running candidates in the elections. Tell us about that. This is really interesting now. I mentioned earlier on speaking with Professor Dolores Cahill and reading about the Freedom Alliance and some of the things it's trying to achieve. What are you going to do? Yeah. Where are you going to run? And how are you going to go about that?
So I'm going to be running for candidate for the northeast of Scotland. I hoped that the Freedom Alliance Party has given me the opportunity to get through to Scottish Parliament with the truth of it, exactly what's going on. I just want to be able to speak out for people. I want to ensure medical freedom, informed choice. I want the people's voices to be heard. That's really important to me, you know. Also, within the Freedom Alliance Party in the UK, every region has an NHS worker, NHS worker standing for candidate, apart from one, I think it's just one area that there's not an NHS previous.
That's some achievement, that, working. Isn't it?
Yeah.
To be able to field candidates in all but one constituency is a remarkable achievement.
In the whole of the UK. But it's absolutely phenomenal. And for the research that I've done, I've been led to the Freedom Alliance Party, and everything that they stand for is exactly what I believe in. You know, so I want to be out there, and I've never ever seen myself doing anything like this. And the fear that's in the world at the moment, it's a tragedy that people are scared to speak out. I have spoke out for many years. My children have got a rare genetic condition, and I have spoke out on their behalf as an advocate for a lot of years within the medical profession. So I hope that I can speak out for my constituency, you know, and get word out, and we can sort of unite together just for peace.
And should people go to freedomalliance.co.uk? Is that the best place to go?
Yes, please. And you know, we're actually looking for crowdfunding. If anybody could go on to the freedomalliance.co.uk and have a look at our website, and if you support us, please come over and join in the crowdfunding, give us some ideas of what we can do, because we want to join as a nation and stop these hideous lockdown rules and things. You know, we really want to get out there and promote.
There's a donation button on the homepage. It's freedomalliance.co.uk. Again, freedomalliance.co.uk. I'll retweet that and I'll put it on Facebook as well.
Thank you so much.
No, not at all. Thanks for getting in touch with the programme. You've been incredibly candid in what you had to say. It's distressing for me and anybody else, really, knowing what has happened in the last 12 months, you know, to hear from basically someone who was right there that it's been one massive lie after another is distressing enough, you know. And then you have to wonder about the vaccines and vaccine safety, and you know, you've given good reasons why you're concerned about the vaccines as well. You know, I just thank you for coming on, really, Kirsty, and wish you and the Freedom Alliance Party all the very best. If there's anything you want to say that you think hasn't been said, I suppose now's the best time to say it. I just want to give a shout out to Tracy McCallum, who's a friend of the programmes, and also Jenny Collins, who's a very good friend going back a few years, for getting in touch and for recommending that you come on. So if there's anything you think you haven't said, but that being said, you know, you are welcome to come back again in the near future. It'll be good to have you back on.
Thank you. I just want to really thank all the all the people out there that have come to me in such hard, one of the hardest times of my life. Jenny Collins been one of them. She's been absolutely amazing. There's been so many. I'm trying to get used to everybody's name. They have kept my spirit up and believed in me and never judged me. And I know that I'm going to go forward with very truly amazing people in my life now. So that it's a new journey within itself. And we're all fighting for freedom to just have the freedom of choice and not for us not to have that taken away from us. So I just want to thank them very much.
Brilliant. Hey, next time we talk, it's my fault that we're doing it over the mobile, by the way. I didn't make enough time for us to set up the technical thing to do it the other way. We'll do it the other way next time you come on. And you are welcome to come back on. I'm sure you'll have plenty to say. And when you do, to consider the programme a platform to do it on. Kirsty, good luck. I mean that. All the very best with everything. And do stay in touch, please.
I will, Richie. Thank you. Take care.
Not at all. You too. Bye for now. Kirsty Miller there, live on the line from her home in Scotland. You've seen the TikTok video. Thanks again to Tracy and to Jenny for putting her in touch with the programme. I'm going to take my leave of you now. I will be with you on Sunday morning at 10 o'clock with Sunday Morning Melodies. Until then, you have a fantastic weekend and look after yourselves and one another. Bye from me. Until Sunday. Bye now.